This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Joining me on Insight is Capital is Kevin Carter, founder and CIO of EMQQ Global. Kevin is a pioneer in emerging markets investing, having launched 10 ETFs in his career on the New York Stock Exchange. Among them, in 2014, notably the Emerging Markets Internet ETF, FMQQ as well, the Next Frontier Internet ETF, and most recently, INQQ, the India Internet Index ETF. He has partnered and collaborated for over the past 20 years with Princeton economist Dr. Burton Malkiel, author of the classic investment bestseller, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, in the launch of numerous super successful investing startups, including e-investing and active index advisors. Kevin then spent something around 8 years at Guggenheim Partners managing and launching their China-focused ETFs before leaving and founding EMQQ Global and, in 2014, the Emerging Markets Internet ETF EMQQ. Kevin, welcome. It is great to get you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about how you got into the business in the first place.
Well, it wasn't, I guess, planned and really any of it, but I live in San Francisco and I have lived here my whole life. I did go away to the University of Arizona and got an economics degree and graduated, and I came back to San Francisco to figure out what to do with my life. And my uncle got me an interview at a company called Roberts and Stevens and Company,
right,
which was, in the 80s and 90s, it was the leading investment bank in San Francisco, and it was the leading technology investment bank in the world. And so I went into the city for my interview, and we talked about college basketball for 20 minutes, and then the guy said, you can start Monday. And I said, well, I don't know anything. How can I start Monday? And he told me to go and buy A Random Walk Down Wall Street and read it over the weekend. So I did that.
Yeah.
And I showed up to work Monday. As you know, that book is pretty well known and pretty important because when it was first written in 1973, the author, Burt Malkiel, laid out his idea for a new investment product, which is called an index fund. So there were no index funds at that time. And he laid out in three paragraphs his idea for a new investment product. And he suggested the New York Stock Exchange make this index fund as a not-for-profit business.
Yeah.
They chose not to do it, but his friend John Bogle did and launched Vanguard not long after that. So that book's all about indexing in efficient markets. The author, a longtime Vanguard board member. And also, one thing people don't know as much about Burt Malkiel is that he was in charge of launching the first ETF, the SPDR,
where
he was the chairman of the new products committee at the American Stock Exchange. So anyway, I started by reading about indexing, but I very quickly realized that when it comes to investing, I'm not a passive person. I'm an Omaha person, and I try to look through every business and investment decision through a Berkshire Hathaway, Charlie Munger, kind of lens. So that's how I got started, and then just one thing led to another and here I am now, focusing on emerging markets.
Yeah, I mean, it's reminiscent what you said about the Omaha mindset. It's reminiscent of the Kahneman Tversky book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And the more pensive, slower paced, deeper thinking attitude that's pervasive in Warren Buffett lore is definitely probably the more successful of the two schools of thought, versus thinking fast. And A Random Walk Down Wall Street suggested, the formation of index funds at low cost. There was obviously a lot of resistance among the manufacturers of products to do this because, like even today, where's the money in that, right? Where's the profit center in running a zero cost ETF or a near zero cost ETF? And that's where we are today, where, there's been this race to the bottom in the indexing world. So having started your career at an active investing company. What was your key takeaway? Was it, did you find it odd that you know, your reading suggestion was Burton Malkiel, even though it is one of the great books of the business?
You know what, the fact that the person that told me to buy that book is actually incredibly startling, especially in hindsight.
Yeah.
Because he was a mutual fund executive, and you know, one of the things about A Random Walk Down Wall Street and about Burt Malkiel and Vanguard is that, you know, they're on the investor's side, right?
Right.
They're the good guys, if you will. They're there to help investors. And so, you know, here's what happened, you know, in my evolution. So I started off as this cocky young value investor wannabe. I worked as an analyst and sold research ideas to hedge funds and mutual funds. And in my mid-20s, I was making a lot of money getting paid for, you know, different investment ideas by these fund companies. And I remember at one point thinking, because I had a large Colorado-based fund family as a client, and one year they paid me several hundred thousand dollars in commissions, but I only talked to them about one company. And the person that was directing those trades, he owned 800 companies. And I remember thinking, like, because when he was paying me those commissions, he wasn't paying those. It was the shareholders of his fund that were paying them. And so I had, you know, after I read A Random Walk, I read everything I could get my hands on. And of course, Graham and Dodd and all the Berkshire Hathaway annual reports and Peter Lynch and so forth. And it was in 1995, I think, or 1996, but the Berkshire Hathaway annual report came out, and I got it, and I was reading it on a Tuesday afternoon after I got home from work. And I read this passage from Warren Buffett where he said most investors, both individual and institutional, would be better off just buying an index fund. And that blew my mind, as they say, because I was, you know, as I tell people, I pray towards Omaha, and I'm trying to figure out how to do this Omaha thing. And the person I'm praying towards is telling me, don't even try, just, you know, give up and buy the index. And that got in my head. And then I sort of, you know, disaggregated the whole thing. And I realized he was absolutely right. Because,
right,
you know, and this is, anytime I see a Boston-based, you know, traditional mutual fund company CEO say, oh, well, now's a stock picker's market, or, you know, it's been easy for the passive to beat the index, you know, to beat everyone, because, you know, all these different excuses. But the reason that indexing wins is simple mathematics, right? If the average active mutual fund charges you a management fee of, you know, say 1%, and then generates other expenses of, say, 0.5%, well, then you've got a 1.5%, you know, just to get back to what the market does, you're already in a hole. And so it's just a simple bell curve. If the, you know, if the market does 11, you're going to get 9.5%. And on average, because, you know, they can't all be better than average. And that's, you know, 1.5% difference. But then if you then do the rest of the investment math, which is to, you know, string those numbers out into the future, 1.5% difference becomes a lot more than 1.5% in 10 years and in 20 years. And it becomes hundreds of percent. And so I realized that, in fact, that the entire active mutual fund business was like a tax. It was like a 1.5% tax on everybody's wealth every year. And so, you know, back in the 90s, I mean, the richest people in the country were always, you know, some of, not all of them, but a large majority of them were the guys that had started the mutual fund companies and just collected that 1.5% on a growing base,
yeah,
decades and decades. So that's when I decided I wanted to fight the system, and became, I don't know what you'd call me, a crusader and
acolyte.
And I quit my job as an analyst, and I took a year off, and I got married, and I just kept thinking about everything. And then when my wife and I went on a 4-month, this is kind of what got me started on emerging markets a little bit, but we went on a 4-month trip through South America and Africa.
Right.
And I was in Africa, and I was sort of doodling on this notebook I brought with me. And I thought, all right, well, if we could just start from scratch and do everything, you know, from scratch, what's the first thing that people are supposed to do to invest? Well, they have to do it. They have to put money into the stock market.
Right.
Okay. How do you do that? Well, you every month you put in as much money as you can save. Okay, well, how, I got $500. How do I put that in the stock market? Well, you couldn't put it into the stock market, because if you wanted to go directly into the stock market, you had to buy 100 shares of a stock to get the lowest commission, which was $29. And the average stock was $30 a share. So that meant if you wanted to buy one stock, you needed $3,000 to put into the stock market, which meant you couldn't do that. You had to go to a mutual fund and let them put it into the stock market, but they'd also charge you all these fees and pay commissions to people like me, right?
Right.
And so I just got fixated on this. I'm like, well, why can't I buy a dollar worth of a stock, or take my $500 and put it into 10 stocks? And I studied it and contemplated it. Now, the internet had just showed up, so you couldn't have done this without the internet. But I thought, well, what if I aggregated, you know, what if I get 100 people that want to put $100 a month into Berkshire Hathaway or whatever stock it was? Well, then you could, you know, make the trade and split it all up. And I also found, I knew that fractional shares existed. I mean, you may remember this, but
right.
Back in the olden days, you could send $50, you could send a $50 check to Campbell's Soup, and they would issue you $50 worth of stock.
Right. That was like an employee. That was like the equivalent of an employee shareholder plan, but for the public.
It was, I think they call it a direct stock purchase plan. And not everybody. Right. And at first I thought, well, I can just make a marketplace and aggregate all of those, but only, you know, 50 companies had them, and they were tended to be older companies. So
it was very limited.
That's when I realized that we needed to create a brokerage platform that would allow you to trade in fractional shares and build their own fund, which in fact, that's what we called the product was called Build Your Own Fund. And I also, I took a lot of,
yes,
I was very angry that, you know, we had taken this new technology and everyone was trading stocks, and it was e-trade. And I kept saying, no, we need to e-invest. And so I found the domain einvesting.com, which was actually owned by a man that was a night janitor at a hospital in Western Canada.
Right.
And I remember him explaining to me where he lived. I had never been to that area. I've been to it since, but I was trying to understand this, I think, the desert that he was explaining to me. And anyhow, I paid him $25,000, and I bought the e-investing website, and I started this online brokerage firm. But I asked Bert Malkiel if he would be an advisor to the business.
Yeah. And now, how did you meet? I mean, was there, had you met?
Yeah, in 1998.
Yeah.
I had just gotten back from this round the world trip, and I was trying to figure out, you know, I was a value investor. Cisco was the only thing people wanted to talk about. And I was just kind of a, you know, bitter, young, cocky value guy. And I was shorting Amazon.com. And
Well, there was a time when that was a good idea. There was a couple of occasions when shorting Amazon proved.
No. I learned some good, you know, yeah. As they say, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So I got a lot of experience that week. So I shorted Amazon. I think it was $50,000 worth. I know I was 20, whatever. I was, you know, that's what I think it was, $50,000 of Amazon stock. And in one day, I already had lost $35,000.
Wow.
Or whatever the amount was. And, yeah. And of course, when you short something and it doesn't work, your exposure gets bigger.
Right.
And so, but the same day that happened, I saw a company change its name from KTEL to KTEL.com. And it was a company I didn't know was public. I'd heard about it when I was a kid. They made record albums, you know, great.
Right. Hits. Yeah. The greatest hits.
But it was like a penny stock, basically. And they changed their name to KTEL.com. And the stock went from $1 to $30. And I said, oh my goodness, I've read about this.
Yeah.
I've heard about this, people changing their names. This is a thing. And I found my random walk and I pulled it off the shelf and I went to the chapter on valuations and bubbles. And there was a quote from the 1960s from Jack Dreyfuss, who used to have a big mutual fund company. And he said, as an example of this technology craze from the 60s, he said, take a company called Shoelaces Incorporated, change the name to Silicon and Electronic Firth Burners. And it used to sell for 8 times earnings, but now it sells for 64 times earnings because you gave it this name. And I said, oh my gosh, you could cross out shoelaces, put in KTEL, cross out, you know, Silicon and put in .com. And I said, I have to call this guy. I have to call, he has to know this is happening.
Yeah.
And so I went onto my computer. I don't know which search engine I used. Google didn't exist yet, but either way, Burton's
Alta Vista.
Maybe Alta Vista.
Yeah.
But his Princeton, you know, back then the web was pretty simple, but there was Burt Malkiel and there was his picture and his phone number and his fax number and his office hours and his, you know, class schedule. And I just dialed the phone. I don't know what I was thinking. I thought I'd get a secretary.
Amazing. That's amazing right off the bat. I mean, just that you know, you know about this infamous investing pioneer and professor and PhD, you know, who has, you know, written the book on the industry long before this era. And you just pick up the phone and call him. I love it.
Well, I just did it and he answered. And I was like, well, gee, Dr. Malkiel, I don't know you, but you got to see this. It's right out of your book. Now, we had this nice conversation and I thought he really liked me. Now, I've learned that he's maybe just the coolest human on the planet and he's nice to everybody. But I thought maybe he liked me in particular. But anyhow, I faxed it. He asked me to fax him a Bloomberg printout of this story. And I did that. And that was it. And then a year later, when I had my idea, I called him. I said, hey, do you remember me? He said, yes. He probably didn't, but he was just probably being nice. And I explained what I wanted to do and whether he would be an advisor. And he said, that sounds like that would be very good for investors. And I would love to be an advisor, but I want to meet you first.
Right.
So you'll have to come to Princeton. So I got a plane ticket, flew out to Princeton and met him at his office. And we went and had a 3-hour lunch and we've been working together ever since. So it's been pretty fun. He's a great guy. And, I've really enjoyed, collaborating with him.
Yeah. So now what led to the genesis of e-investing? That was something that you approached Dr. Malkiel about as well, right?
Yeah. So I asked him to be an advisor to the e-investing, the fractional share brokerage firm. And we built this platform. And just before we ended up selling the company to E-Trade. There was a,
right.
We were about to get a financing from Ameritrade, from TD Ventures. And in fact, the day that I had a term sheet from TD Ventures and the morning I was supposed to sign it, the cover of the Wall Street Journal and Money and Investing section had an article about a competitor we had. We didn't know we had a competitor. We thought this was our own unique idea. And all of a sudden there was an article talking about this company, but they mentioned us in the second paragraph.
Right.
And at like 7:30 in the morning, E-Trade called and said, we want to talk to you. And I said, well, I'm about to sign this thing. I can't really talk to you. They said, well, have you signed it yet? And I said, no. And they said, well, come down. We'll see you in 2 hours. So I drove down to E-Trade and, you know, next thing you know, they said they wanted to buy it. So yeah. We sold the company. I just wanted to get this to the masses and they already had 3 million customers. So I thought, great, let's just get this thing right out there. So anyway, Burton and I collaborated on that.
Kevin, thanks for sharing that because I don't think a lot of people know that you and Dr. Malkiel were at the forefront of bringing this innovation of fractional share investing to the public in a mass way, as opposed to, you know, like there might have been some smaller practitioners here and there or smaller outfits doing that, but when the internet came along, obviously you saw an avenue for where you could bring this to the masses, to the investing public, where you know, people who wanted, who desired to invest in companies, but there was this roadblock. And on top of that, I think you were also sort of the anti, you know, the mutual fund was the solution to that problem, was the everyday solution to that problem. But you kind of came along and you were like the anti-mutual fund solution.
That's build right? your own fund. That's yeah. what we called it.
Yeah.
So yes, that was the idea. And I'm, you know, as you rightfully pointed out, I mean, this was other people had, as with nearly everything, there's always, you know, other smart people. There are other people out there that have probably thought of something similar and or are working on it. As we found out that right. morning when it was on the paper, we said, we knew we had picked up a little clue along the way that somebody else might be working on this. As we were talking to potential partners, and one of them, you know, abruptly said, "We can't talk to you anymore." Right. So yeah. then we knew something, somebody else was doing something. So, but anyhow, I'm glad it's gone mainstream. And, you know, I'd like to think it was a contribution to the cause. And then, it was a fun experience. And, you know, it was right in the .com. We had a dumpy little office that, you know, the cheapest office in downtown San Francisco. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
That's very cool. And so now it ramped up very quickly, right? It ramped up very quickly. E-Trade acquired e-investing from you and Dr. Malkiel. And then what came next? You did.
Well,
I mean,
once we got acquired, there wasn't too much for me to do at E-Trade. They already had all the customers. So I was only there for, you know, 9 months or so. And then I left and I had a year off and I moved to the suburb. I had a baby like the week after we sold the company. So I was kind of going into family mode. But I stayed in touch with Burton and we kept talking about this other idea that was, now that we've cracked the share barrier, now, okay, that's the how. And then the question is what? Okay, now I can invest $50 in the stock market or $100. What do I buy?
Yeah.
Now this is where there's, you know, on one end of the spectrum is the John Bogle, you know, just buy the, and Ed Burt Malkiel, just buy the index and keep your cost lows. And on the other end is Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett. And so what I had concluded when I was doing my doodling in Africa was that it's not really a line like this. It's more like a circle. And
right.
down here is Warren Buffett and John Bogle, right? And they're closer than all the other stuff is. And this is also, I think, reflected by Warren Buffett obviously supporting indexing as much and perhaps with as much money as anybody else. And I kind of felt like all the problem with the mutual fund and other, you know, active, you know, parts of the different product structures, but active, you know, managers that have 50, 60, 70 stocks is you're not going to beat the index with that many stocks. I mean, this is another thing I picked up in a random walk when I first read it was, you know, once you have 30 stocks, you own the stock market. The odds of you beating the stock market if right. you own 30 stocks is incredibly low. And as I mentioned, I was talking to some of these portfolio managers that had 800 stocks. And so, you know, I kind of felt like all of the stuff between Omaha and Vanguard was just, you know, just gobbledygook. And that, the over diversification that happened would eliminate the chance to really perform. But I knew that putting Omaha, if you will, stock picking into a
yeah.
formula, I mean, then you're just in a mix with, oh, sure, you're the guy, right? So, but we knew indexing, you know, the indexing idea we knew could be implemented in a way. And so we thought, well, why don't we make a 50 stock port? Because you didn't, you know, even though you could, if you invested $50 a month and you had fractional share, you could put a penny into all 500 stocks or 10, right. 10 cents, but you wouldn't want that. Your statement would be too long and it wouldn't be practical. So how do we take the S&P 500 and shrink it into a 50 stock portfolio? So that, you know, let's leave all the active stuff out of this and let's just say, okay, now I can save $50 a month, $100, $500. What do I buy?
Right.
Buy the index. And here's our, you know, here's a miniature version of the S&P 500. So we'll, and then the Burton and I had, you know, hours and hours of discussions about, okay, well, how do you pick those 50 stocks? Do you buy the biggest 50? Right. Do you just take the top 50 and say that's close enough? Because that'll get you 85% of the market cap. But
right.
Anyhow, we decided that this was a new thing as well, that we wouldn't be passively indexing, we'd be actively indexing. Because once you had direct control, you could customize.
Right.
You could say, well, I don't want to own tobacco stocks or, you know, whatever it was. It could be that I'm an executive at Intel. I'm not allowed to own Intel stocks.
So, right, exactly. I mean, in your neck of the woods in San Francisco, in the, you know, Silicon Valley proximity that you have, I mean, direct indexing is a very attractive idea, especially if you have huge single stock risk working for one of these companies like Google or, I mean, or Alphabet or Microsoft or Intel. You know, as an employee or as a, you know, management at these companies, or even engineers, whatever, you're sitting on all this single stock risk. Are you going to then buy an S&P 500 index that also owns shares in the company you work at? And as you said, you know, I'm not allowed to own, stock in a particular company because I work at another company, right?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of other things that once you had this platform, there are a lot of things you could do both to customize for reasons like those.
Well, and as you said, ESG before there was ESG, when it was just socially, you know, SRI, socially responsible.
That's right, SRI, yeah. Socially responsible investing. In fact, I'll come back to that because that's a good lesson. There's a good lesson in this about SRI and ESG. But so that was the idea. And I remember saying, brother, let's be the indexing separate accounts. Because back then, and this is still a problem in the investment world, that from the day I started, there was like, you're either a value investor or a growth investor. And you got put into one box or the other, right? And I didn't like that because I always thought, well, value is a price tag thing and a you know, what you're buying is a, you know, a business thing, right? So I want growing businesses, but I also want to be mindful of the price. I mean, they shouldn't be exclusive. And at the time, the separately managed account business was exploding, being sold through financial advisors. And the advisors all had a menu and here's the five approved growth managers and here's the five approved value managers. And they're going to charge you 1.5% and they're not going to beat the market probably, but you know, it'll feel cooler to you to own the stocks directly. And I thought, well, why shouldn't there be a middle piece in there that's just, I just want to buy the U.S. large cap equity as defined by the S&P 500. And then once you, because in, the other problem you had, if you fired a separate account manager, but you owned all of these stocks, right?
Right.
If you decided to hire a new manager, they would sell all of them indiscriminately. Taxes, they didn't care.
Yeah. In order to
what we could do is say, give us what's left over, right?
Right.
And we can use it. The pieces that are at gains, we won't sell the ones you're going to pay taxes on, and we'll use that as part of your technology exposure, and we'll use this as part of your healthcare. The ones that you've lost money on, we'll get rid of those. Because the real, you know, investment logic for this is that for taxable investors, you could beat the index after tax. If you
a tax alpha.
Tax alpha. We invented that term. That's what we call it. So anyhow, we built this platform called Active Index Advisors. I brought in people from iShares. I've ended up employing lots of iShares portfolio managers.
Which was based also in San Francisco.
Correct.
Yeah.
And And I had my tech team that was from my first business, and we basically built a completely scalable platform to manage an infinite number of index-based separately managed accounts in a fully automated way. We ended up selling the company to Natixis because once we had the platform, we didn't have any salespeople, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it was pretty early. I mean, there was a lot of pushback on this. Was we'd go around San Francisco and show people what we were building, and they'd say, "Well, this is crazy. No one's going to do this. It's a high cost index fund. What about when it's all gains?" You know. So,
yeah.
But there were, but here again, this is one of those things where the other people were onto this. In fact, when I did my first test marketing locally, I met with this one advisor, and he said, "Oh, do you know Paul Soli at Aperio Group?" And I said, "No." He said, "I just met a guy. I think he's doing the same thing." And I said, "Really?" And so I got in touch with this guy, and we went and had lunch at the Tadich Grill, and it turned out we were both doing the same thing. And we literally started like almost the same day. And we said, "Great. Well, we're, you know, at least now we know we're a sector and a little industry here. You got Aperio and us." And there was another one also too here in the Bay Area. But anyhow, so the one thing that I think is still the case that is the vast majority, if not all of the direct indexing people are using optimizers, which I think is not a good way to do this. We built a stratified sampling methodology that I thought was a much more pure way to do directed. We didn't call it direct indexing either, by the way. That was
that's a new term.
Someone changed the name, but anyhow.
So Kevin, that's fascinating. I mean, I think it goes a long way to sort of understanding your philosophy. And sorry, my phone just rang. It goes a long way to explaining, you know, where you've come from, your pioneering days in terms of having been. I don't think a lot of people know. I'm sure there's a lot of people who do know you for your accomplishments, but I have a feeling that there's a lot more people who don't know, you know, what you've accomplished in your career in terms of bringing these innovations to market and actually having been, you know, the early pioneers in so many things. And now to add to that is your pioneering in emerging markets and being involved directly in the early launches of emerging markets funds and ETFs. And so what was the genesis of your interest in getting into the emerging markets area? What was the story behind that?
Well, this is another thing I didn't really plan, but it went like this. So we sold active index advisors to Natixis, right. Ironically, a big Boston-based mutual fund company.
Right. Originally French, but...
That's founded by Napoleon, actually. Yeah. I used to make jokes about legacy systems and Napoleon.
That's fascinating. You know, as that reminds me of the Eagle Fund, right? I mean, in terms of being originally founded by the founding fathers of, you know, the American Constitution.
Oh my gosh, I don't think I even knew about that. But okay, it's something new to be a fan.
It was something that's actually something I learned from Scott Galloway's podcast, where he talked about how the Eagle Fund is actually the government's venture capital arm. Which was started by, I believe, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, among others.
Okay, I can't wait to learn more about this.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised I've never heard of this before. But
you'll find it. You'll find it actually in if you are interested, and for anyone listening who's interested, look up Scott Galloway's Prof Galloway.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Yeah. I mean, but for listeners, if you look up Prof Galloway and you look up recently, like one of his most recent podcast / posts was titled The Queen of Welfare, Elon Musk, Queen of Welfare. Elon Musk, Welfare Queen. And it's all about how, you know, some of the biggest venture capital beneficiaries, you know, go on to do things like shitposting the fact that you know, companies are getting money from the government or from government venture sources.
Yes,
right. Okay. Among them, Elon Musk and you know, the you know, his battery factory, which was funded by $465 million of U.S. government funds.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Interesting. Well,
yeah, anyways. So
he sold the company to the Texas.
Yeah.
And that was that deal closed in December of 2004. But just before we sold the company, Google went public. I think it was in August of 2004.
Right.
And Burton called me and said, "Hey, I'm going to be in San Francisco. I'm giving a pre-talk at Google before the IPO." So they had like an investor planning day. And it was, I think, Bill Sharp and Burton were the two guest speakers. Eric Schmidt and Burton are Princeton friends, I think. And so I had dinner with Burton. I didn't get invited to the investor planning day at Google, but anyhow. And a few months later, my phone rang. And it was a guy from Google who had Googled me, apparently. And he said, "Hey, I saw Professor Malkiel speak, and he mentioned this active indexing, and how do I invest with you?" And I said, "Well, you know, we only work with advisors at Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley. Do you have an advisor?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, I can introduce you to one." And he said, "I don't want one. I want to invest. I know what I want. I don't need anyone else." And I said, "Well, I don't, you know, we don't really work with individuals, but I'll come down and have lunch with you and maybe we'll see what happens." And so I drove down to Mountain View and I sat down with this kid. I was only 30, but he was like 25. And I explained what we did and I asked him what he did. And he explained that when you misspelled a word in Google and it said, "Did you mean?" that he had done that. And I said, "Okay." and he said, "Well," so I explained what we did. And he said, "Well, how much should I invest in this, you know, active S&P 500 strategy?" And I said, "I don't, it depends on how much money you have." And he said, "I have a lot." And I said, "Okay, well, you're rich, so you should be conservative. But you're 25, so you should be aggressive." And I said, we'll call you moderate, and I don't have a pie chart with me, but, you know, maybe 20% in the S&P. But then he said, "Well, what about the rest of my money?" And I said, "Well, we don't do that. We just do this custom S&P 500.
Right.
And he said, "Well, if you were me, what would you do?" And I said, "I would just find the cheapest ETF for every other asset class. And just, but, you know, that's it. Keep it simple." And he said, "Well, can you do that for me?" And I said, "Sure, I guess. I'm going to have to call Boston and get approval, but you got a lot of money. I'm sure they'll say yes." And when I asked him what he wanted to do with his life, he said, "Artificial intelligence." And then when I asked him if he wanted to leave out tobacco or alcohol, he said, "I never want to own Microsoft." So that's when I realized you can't really prepackage ESG or SRI. It's kind of a customable. It's another, if you really want to express your feelings, direct indexing is certainly the only way you could really do it at the granular level. So anyhow, I basically became this guy's advisor, and then he introduced me to another person. And so 20 years ago, basically every week I was driving down to Mountain View and meeting some other 20-something-year-old, you know, programmer with a lot of money. But when I was doing that, Burton started going to China. Two of his Princeton economist friends were Chinese economists, and they had been offered a lot of money to go back to Beijing around the year 2000. And they, you know, back then China was growing at, you know, 10, 11%, and it was really booming. And they said, "Burton, you have to come visit China. You need to see this with your own eyes. And we've embraced capitalism and, you know, this is happening." So when I was going to Mountain View, he was going to China. And he wrote a white paper with these two men about investing in China that was published in the Journal of Investment Consulting. Google heard about it and called me and said, "Hey, can Burton come talk about China?"
Right.
And I said, "Sure."
next time he's in town, I'm sure he'll be happy to come down and talk about China. And so I picked up Burton one day down by the airport, and we drove to Mountain View, and he gave a talk about China. And when he was done, all of these people looked at me and said, "We want to invest in China." And I didn't know what to say. I said, "Okay, I don't even know what that means exactly. I mean, I read Burton's paper, but we'll figure out what that means." And so literally from the moment that talk ended until today, that's been my effort to figure out what in the world does that mean to invest in China, and how do you do it? And that broadened out to all emerging markets. But anyhow, that's how I got into emerging.
Right, right.
I did not plan that either.
So it started with China, and then it eventually widened. You were at Guggenheim Partners, too, for a stint, too, right?
Well, I wasn't technically part of Guggenheim. They did try to acquire us, which unfortunately we didn't complete. But we had a separate business that was in partnership with Guggenheim. So we made the indexes, and Guggenheim turned them into ETFs, and then we collaborated on the marketing side. But, yeah, so we hooked up with the Guggenheim people and began launching China ETFs. But we also had an institutional strategy. And so I spent about half my time with Guggenheim and, you know, the advisor world. But I spent a lot of my time in New York City and Boston with foundations and endowments and family offices and, you know, the Harvard, Princeton endowment kind of people and the
right.
Dell family and the Bloomberg family and those kind of investors. And, you know, that's how I devoted my first sort of 10 years. And it was heavily focused on China. But the whole effort really for the last 20 years has been essentially the same kind of mission, because after Burton gave the talk, we drove back to Mountain View. I'm sorry, we drove back to San Francisco from Mountain View. And we went up to the office, and I walked right over to our portfolio managers, and I said, "The Google guys want to invest in China. Give me a list of all of the companies in the China ETF." Because I assumed for these Google investors that we would just, you know, if they wanted 5% in China, we would just buy 5% worth of the ETF. But there was only one ETF
right
in the world that invested in China that day, FXI, the ticker symbol, which stands for the FTSE Xinhua Index.
Right.
And so if you wanted to buy China, that was the only choice. So, but since I'm an Omaha person, I don't really care what the name of the fund is. I want to see what are the businesses we're going to own.
Right.
And that's when... And so I asked for the list of companies, and that's when Burton pulled me aside and said, "Kevin, when you get the list, you're going to see most of the companies are Chinese government-owned banks and oil companies." That didn't sound very good, but then he went on to give me a little explanation, and that not only were they obviously inefficient, but they had conflicts of interest.
Right.
That they were frequently corrupt. And that the result was that they didn't care about growing their profits. And that made me nauseous, because in Omaha, you know, investing is really simple. The reason any business has value is because it makes profits for the owners.
Right. Right.
And the only way to grow the value is to grow the profits. And you've just explained to me that not only do these companies don't care about this, the people in charge are more likely to steal your money then grow the profits. And so I thought, this is a problem. And then I got the list of the companies. It was 80% Chinese state-owned enterprises.
Right.
And so, and I also noticed that it was only 8% in consumer stocks. And I already knew that, you know, the thing that was emerging in emerging markets, the thing that was emerging in China were billions of people that wanted stuff. Right. New consumers that wanted food and clothing and heaters,
middle class
conditioners. And that was 8%. And this corrupt legacy economy was 80%. And so
that's basically all I've been working on for 20 years, is trying to tap into the consumer, chop out the legacy corrupt part of the emerging markets. And when I was spending my time in New York and Boston, you know, what I saw happening was that these endowments and foundations were all increasing their exposure. I think Harvard went from 6 to 12% EM. But as they got bigger, they would get more targeted. This concept of emerging markets 3.0, where they slowly increase, but then they get more targeted. And the best example of that was David Swensen at Yale, who took his smartest Chinese alumni, who was working for the endowment, and he said, here's $50 million, go home to Shanghai and start a private equity fund, which worked great. But most people couldn't do that.
Right.
And so when people would ask me, what's the best emerging markets ETF? Because people knew what I did and they'd ask me that. I didn't tell them to buy one of my China ETFs. I said, buy the emerging market consumer ETF. Leave out the banks and the corruption and the oil, and just tap into this growth story that McKinsey calls the biggest ever. The rise of the emerging market consumer, the food companies, the clothing companies, the Walmart of Mexico, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
fast moving consumer goods.
That's right. And, yeah. And that's what I told people to buy for years. And then 11 years ago, I was in my car, and while I was at a stoplight, my first iPhone, which was sitting on my car seat, it rang.
Mm-hmm.
And I answered it. And my friend said, what's the best emerging markets ETF for my daughter's college fund? And I started to say to buy the consumer ETF. And then I had a light bulb moment and I went straight back to my office and I launched EMQQ 100 days later. Because I realized that not only was consumption changing, but that the best consumer stocks were now called technology stocks. And that morning that I got that call, I was looking at my portfolio, which had 5 emerging market consumer stocks in it. 3 of those companies were in the emerging market consumer ETF. They were Chinese food and clothing companies trading in Hong Kong.
Right.
The Nabisco of China, the Reebok of China. You know?
Yeah, the B shares, right?
Want leading, Peak Sports, food and clothing. But I had these 2 other companies I owned that both of them traded in the United States, and both of them were definitely part of the consumer story. But they were not in the consumer ETF because they were called technology companies. One, Wuba, the Craigslist of China, which was incredibly profitable, but got taken over. And the 5th and final company, Mercado Libre, on the NASDAQ, which is the Amazon.com of Brazil. And when I had looked at my portfolio, I was like, well, all of these are consumer stocks. You can put them in the database wherever you want, but, you know, they're obviously playing the same story. And the traditional food and clothing companies were growing at 15%, maybe.
Right.
Maybe 20%. I thought they had moats in terms of their brands. But Mercado Libre was growing at 120%. And while the PEs were higher, the PEG ratios were lower. And so that was really the...
Right.
The aha moment. And what I didn't appreciate, though, you know, what I now it's very clear to me, but there's a huge thing happening in emerging markets. And it's definitely the fastest growing part of emerging markets. And it might be the fastest growing sector in the world in the last 10 years. But basically, those 6.5 billion people that are becoming consumers for the first time are also joining 2 other mega trends. And you know, you and I have been part of these 3 mega trends for, you know, generations now. But most people are just getting started. So, you know, I've had food and clothing and cars and vacations in my life since I was a kid. My brothers and I got to go to college, so have my kids. So, you know, that's we don't think of that as a trend, but, you know, for the rest of the world, it is. The second mega trend that is sweeping the world is something that we've had for decades as well. It's called the computer. So I had a smartphone 11 years ago when I got that call, but I had a computer for 20 years before that. Well, guess what? Most of the world's getting
their first computer today, and it's not a desktop, and it's not an Apple product. It's an Android-based smartphone that is getting better and more affordable every year. You can now get a new smartphone in India for $12, for example.
Wow.
So the computer is the second mega trend, and the third one's called the internet. I got the internet in 1995.
Yeah. I mean, inexpensive computers, you can start with a Chromebook, for example, right?
So pocket-sized supercomputers for $12, and 5G internet wireless connectivity is sweeping the planet. So you're giving 6.5 billion people their first computer and their first internet access today. This is happening today. And because, you know, our experience with consumption and technology has been very gradual, right? These people have never, they've never had a bank account or a credit card or a debit card, and they don't have a car, and there's no Target store. So they're leapfrogging. And the result has been a story of massive growth. I think, you know, since I launched EMQQ 10 years ago or 10 and a half years ago, the revenue growth, the average annual revenue growth for the emerging markets internet sector has been about 35% a year. So massive fundamental growth. Most of it in China so far.
Yeah. But I mean, there's one thing with emerging markets is that they've had their ins and outs, their rough spots, whether it's political or ideological or policy making decisions like the plans out of China, the 5-year plans that come, policy changes from, you know, Xi Jinping since he came into power, rolling back free market reforms in China. We had a change of government in India, which was, you know, populist with Modi. It started out as a very populist movement, but he has moderated over time and, you know, wants to continue on the path of liberalizing India. But also, like, politically, two different, if we're talking about the two largest emerging markets economies without considering, Latin America and Africa, India has a democracy and a rule of law, and China is the command economy with the ultimate ruler. And how do you distinguish between the two? I mean, India looks more Western in terms of its makeup, you know, political and market makeup, and China looks more like, China is what it is, right? It's a communist command economy. But is the growth that has been pent up, like, it hasn't, you know, there was a time, I think, in the early 2000s when, you know, India, for example, experienced very big gains in re-rating and, you know, recognition and multiple expansion, for the same reasons that we're talking about, which is the growth of the consumer, the adoption of technology. And then there was interruptions because of the GFC, the tech wreck was an interruption for India, to some degree. But what I always look back, when I look back to 2007, 2008, you know, post the tech wreck, I'll never forget, you know, companies like Tata, for example, Tata Consultancy or Tata, the Tata Enterprise in India, was buying up all of the bandwidth that Global Crossing had given basically away in bankruptcy, right? So there was this race, there was like an arms race to put as much fiber optic cabling around the planet in the heyday of the, you know, tech boom. And then when Global Crossing and WorldCom and, you know, a whole bunch of companies went under, in swooped the, you know, these progressive Indian companies to buy up all that bandwidth. And then for the, you know, and then there was this huge amount of bandwidth that was dark, fiber optic bandwidth that was dark. And gradually, like since the time that you've been, you know, that you launched your funds, your first fund, your first ETF, that bandwidth has been getting absorbed by this growing consumer class that is using more and more technology in the palm of their hands, this, you know, as you say, the supercomputer in the palm of your hands for $12 is eating up the capacity of that dark, of what was once dark fiber optic cable. But so if there's been like a compression of valuation over the last 10 years since you launched EMQQ, and subsequently you launched in 21, you launched FMQQ and INQQ in the spring of 22. That must have been a kind of a weird time to launch, right? We were still in the midst of COVID.
Oh, it was a terrible time to launch. Yeah. Actually, if you look at the chart, you'll see that you'll see that both of them started with a negative 50% as their opening year.
Yeah,
because there was a there was a lot of things that happened in 2021 that the risk-free rate went from 0 to 5%, but there also was a bit of a bubble in the emerging market internet companies in India,
right,
as well. So I mean, there was a few things that happened. That on the China front, you had these two incredibly negative, scary things that were in the papers every week. There was the delisting story that the U.S. government was going to kick Alibaba off of the U.S. Right. stock exchanges, and that investors were going to lose all their money. And yeah, both of them,
Jack Ma disappeared.
What's that?
Jack Ma disappeared.
Well, that was a different story. Yeah. That was second story. That was the China. So it wasn't just the U.S. government coming to steal your money, but then on top of that, the Chinese government was trying to kill the internet. So
yeah,
so you had those two stories going side by side for 24 months, and it scared the heck out of people. And all of it was, what I think you would call fake news, in my opinion, because the delisting thing was ridiculous and was never going to happen. And if you really understood the situation, you have a lot more questions about the United States because,
yeah.
That we didn't enforce our own rule for 20 years. And then when we tried to enforce it, the agency that was supposed to enforce it, all of them got fired by the SEC. So the Chinese didn't have the Chinese didn't have a counterpart for a year until the SEC restaffed the accounting watchdog. And, 9 months later, they resolved it. But no one knows that. All they knew was they're cheating on their accounting and they're going to get kicked off and I'm going to lose all my money. Because no one's ever been to China. They've never been to India either. And in the case of China, as you pointed out, because they have a communist government, people are just afraid of China, right? And all of these things, like they're making up the numbers, Jack Ma's missing, these things get perpetrated and people think they're true.
Right.
So that part was ridiculous. The China tech crackdown, it was also just completely misunderstood. I've followed this closer than 99.9% of the people, and all four of the regulatory things that happened in China, I supported. The stopping the Ant Group, they had to do that because Ant Group was going to be the largest IPO ever because it was incredibly profitable, but most of the profits came from lending money outside of the financial system.
Right.
And that's not allowed. Now, it was a loophole they were using, but the regulators were going to fix it. And that rather than wait till after the IPO and then chop them at the knees, their profitability, because they needed them to reserve. Right. I mean, it's a profitable business to lend money and not reserve. So anyhow, but either way, everybody believed both of those storylines. And if everyone believes it, then it's going to be true. And it got to a point where China became literally uninvestable. And, if you think about how investor psychology or behavioral finance works, you've got bearish and bullish, positive, negative. I'm going to lose my money. I'm going to get rich. China went so far to the negative that the arm flew off and it became uninvestable. So nobody should be surprised by the violent, move upwards, because I don't remember an entire asset class being deemed uninvestable, but it's probably a good time to look at buying something that's, if it's still alive.
So what I was going to say was that it's basically like emerging markets because of these ins and outs that have occurred over the last decade, they look like a coiled spring.
Right? Well, here's what I'm ready to
burst into the future, ready to go forward. I think, you know, like there was the David Tepper buy signal in December, you know, where David Tepper came on CNBC and he said he's buying everything in China because they're so cheap and so out of favor that, you know, how can you possibly go wrong? And then there's a shift in policy. There's a shift in sentiment about at the heart of this whole debacle is this TikTok controversy of whether or not TikTok is going to be acquired by an American company in order to keep it listed, in order to keep it going. ByteDance has to give up. You know, like we've got this all this trade stuff happening now that's really sort of, you know, muddying the water. But would you say that there's a lot of pent-up value in the emerging markets in general because there was so much favoritism going on with U.S. equities the last 10, 12 years?
That's definitely the case. But here, let me just make sure I cover a couple of more important things that are kind of high level. The fact is that, emerging markets, the MSCI Emerging Market Index, which is what, you know, most investors look at and reference when they see how have emerging markets done. In the last 10 years, it's gone nowhere. I mean, the return is essentially zero. But what's important is the revenue hasn't gone up and the earnings haven't gone up. In fact, both the revenue and earnings have gone down. And so the traditional emerging market index is a value trap. And it's because of all of the state-owned enterprises. And the other thing that's important to know is the internet companies, the most dynamic companies in emerging markets, most of them are not included in the MSCI index. Now, Alibaba was finally added, but not till several years after they went public. But Mercado Libre, the largest company in Latin America, is not in the index. The best performing stock in Latin America is not in the index. The two biggest Latin American holdings are not only Petrobras, the corrupt oil company, that's the largest. The second largest is Petrobras Preferred. So, I'm never optimistic about the broad index, at least in terms of really growing value. Now, that doesn't mean they might not come into favor and they might not outperform. And my gut is that reference Tepper in China. It feels like China's gone from uninvestable to investable. It's, you know, they took the arm of the scale off of the table and reattached it. So at least you can, you know, invest in it again, which is the whole thing silly, but
that's
but,
a great way of putting it.
I mean, but so my sense is that it very well may be a rotation, you know, it's because EM has been out of favor, but you still ultimately you need earnings growth to grow value. And the reason the S&P's done well is because it's had massive earnings growth. And sometimes the multiples will get ahead of themselves, sometimes they'll get behind, but you do need earnings growth to really make money. And then just to touch on the one other thing about, you know, China versus India. When I look at the growth of the emerging markets internet sector, this massive growth, 80% of that in the last 10 years was China. And China, you know, China is an emerging market in a traditional sense. But when it comes to the smartphone, when it comes to e-commerce, live stream shopping, China's the most developed country in the world by far. And what you saw was this massive growth as the FANG stocks took over our world first. Right. And then the China internet took over the China economy, right? And now we're on to the third wave. So the first wave was the United States, you know, FANG stocks starting in the year 2000, first on mobile phones, then on smartphones, or first on PCs, then on smartphones. Still going, that growth of kind of a AI, you know, boost. The second wave of the internet was the China wave, basically right behind us. I mean, Baidu went public right when Google did. So that was the second wave. But now the next 20 years, it's all about the other emerging markets. China is still the most important one, but its growth rate can't be as high as it was simply because it's
e-commerce penetration is 27% and everybody else is at 5%. And amongst everybody else, India stands alone in every measure.
When you look at China and you look at India and you look at the amount of STEM-related education that is coming out of both countries, and in many cases, highly specialized STEM education, where you have entire universities devoted to one particular discipline, in China, for example, or in India, for that matter, with their institutes of technology, you know, the amount of brain power that's available in these markets for, you know, continuing such things as offshoring from India, for example, expanding on that, and then, you know, the restriction of, you know, the brain drain to the US, for example, with all the new immigration, you know, sort of crackdown that's happening right now. You can see where, you know, that highly specialized education will remain at home in the case of India. And like, I mean, it's less likely right now, at least for the time being, to continue to find its way to the US through the H-1B programs. But if you look at what that means, it's that a lot of folks that have these highly specialized technology related education, are going to stay home. They're going to stay in India and they're going to look for opportunities from that base.
When we come back on, I'm going to pick up when you talked about the brain drain from India.
Okay.
Because even before the visa elements, one of the biggest things going on right now in India is it's becoming entrepreneurial. I mean, the number of startups in India, you know, 5 years or 7 years ago, there was 500 startups. Today, there's 120,000. And one of my favorite companies is actually the two kids that got into Stanford, two Indian friends, and they dropped out when they were freshmen, not to start a company here, but to go home. They started.
Perfect.